Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, the industry's first and longest-running podcast, now in our 15th year. I'm Roger Gross, the publisher of GGB, and this week we feature an interview with Tom Rigg, the CEO of Caesars Entertainment, on the evolution of Eldorado Resorts, which now owns Caesars Entertainment and has taken its name. The GGB Podcast is brought to you by FSB, the industry's leading sports betting solutions and technology platform. For more information, visit fsbtech.com. Is a far cry from the nodding wind, here at Traitor's Gate. 'Cause the high heel he used to be has been ground down, and it listens for the footsteps that would follow him. Tom Rigg is a deal maker, and he landed in the right place in the 1990s when he got involved with a small family-owned company called Eldorado Resorts. Rigg helped the Carano family guide the company outside of its native Reno, Nevada, on a journey that saw it buy several smaller regional gaming companies, MTR Gaming, Isle of Capri, and Tropicana Entertainment. However, when he set his sights on Caesars Entertainment, few thought it was possible. But when Rigg demonstrated the savings Eldorado could bring to the gaming giant, the experts began to listen. If the Eldorado operations model has worked in the following other acquisitions, why couldn't it work for Caesars? And the deal got done. Rigg spoke with me from his offices at Caesars Palace in Las Vegas in August for the cover story of the October issue of GGB. Tom Rigg, thanks for joining us on the podcast today. Great to see you here in Las Vegas. I know you're all over the country these days within your new role here, but I think you're going to be visiting Vegas a little more frequently than often, right?
Yes, been here quite a bit since July 20th when we closed.
Sure.
Expect to be spending a lot of time here, particularly early on.
Sure. Well, we're in the flagship of your company, Caesars Palace, and there's been so many iterations of this company, but one thing that's really been constant has been the image of Caesars Palace. And there's a lot of elements that go along with it. One of it, of course, is the entertainment element. The other is the high rollers. The ultra high rollers, the whales, to a certain extent. Are you guys going to be involved in that game as much as the previous administrations have been?
Yeah, we don't expect to make changes in those areas. Uh-huh. Obviously, both of them are challenged now in terms of headline entertainment.
Sure.
Going to be sidelined for a little while, but that's obviously been a big piece of the business system-wide with Caesars, but particularly in Las Vegas. We plan to continue that, and Caesars has a very well-developed high-end business in Las Vegas.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Centered here at Caesars Palace, and you've got Gary Slesner and Sean McBurney who lead an impressive effort to drive that business to Caesars, and we'd expect to continue that as well.
Sure, no question. And the entertainment, obviously, that's on hold to a certain extent here, but the modern Caesars Palace is built on entertainment with the Coliseum and the residencies and the kind of quirky shows like Absinthe. Are you going to continue along those lines as well?
Yeah, and that's could be a key differentiating factor as things start to open up here. As you know, you've got the 50-person limit on gatherings, which
Right. Kind
of cools everything at
Sure. This
point. But if you look at the portfolio of entertainment that Caesars has across its properties, it has a number of multiple times a night smaller shows, predominantly four-wall variety, but Absinthe being a prime example, Piff the Magic Dragon across the street. Those can be profitable at socially distanced numbers. So we expect that it's not going to go from zero to headliners are back, that
sure,
there's going
right.
to be incremental steps.
Right.
And if that's the case, you could have a situation where across the Caesars portfolio, we have quite a range of entertainment options available at our properties throughout the city, and others that build their calendars much more heavily on headliners and Cirque shows are still sidelined.
So sure, sure.
That could ultimately be an opportunity for us.
And you've had some smaller residences, even though the stars were not smaller, in some of the other properties like Planet Hollywood, they may not be Coliseum bound, but are those going to continue as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, those are you know, Planet Hollywood, a key to Planet Hollywood's traffic is the entertainment piece. Planet mm-hmm. Hollywood is, other than Caesar's Palace, the largest property in terms of visitation from someone staying somewhere
sure.
else
sure.
in Las Vegas. And obviously entertainment is a key driver of that.
Right, right. And of course, here in Vegas, you also have the new Caesars Forum. The what is that, 500,000 square feet, or is it a million?
It's enormous.
Yeah.
Just opened prior to everything shutting for COVID, but that's a big piece of our group sales effort going forward, and we've gotten a lot of traction there in forward sales, you know, when that piece reopens.
Sure. Okay, great. Well, since this is our first time doing a podcast with you, why don't you give us a little background on what you were doing before you came to El Dorado and what really attracted you to the company?
Sure. So I grew up in the investing and banking side of the business. I was a high-yield credit analyst at Bank of America in the 90s, and that was where I met the Carano families. The Caranos did a senior subordinated offering that mm-hmm. we were a manager of in 1996, and mm-hmm. I met Don and his family. I continued on the sell side through the end of the decade. I moved to the investing side of the business in 2002, ran portfolios for AIG, specializing in gaming throughout,
okay.
and then spun off and did my own investment management business. That was actually a part of our backing for that business came from Paul Salem, who's now the chairman okay. of mm-hmm. MGM.
Right. Yep.
So a small world.
Yeah. Well, it's gaming is a small industry.
Yes. But I left the investing side of the business in 2010. I had been on the board of El Dorado, the private company, starting in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
While I was AIG, we had run a bankruptcy auction process for what was then the Hollywood Casino Shreveport asset that was built by the Pratt family, subsequently bought by Penn that had project financing that defaulted. There was an auction. El Dorado won the asset. I joined the board of El Dorado a couple years later in 2007
mm-hmm.
and joined them full-time at the beginning of 2011 with the idea that they wanted to become a public company on the gaming side.
Mm-hmm.
They had the winery business and the gaming business that were both privately held. Don was getting up in age, wanted to have one piece of it liquid for estate planning purposes, and the thought was we would get the gaming entity to the public markets. And so in 2014, put together the deal that where we purchased MTR Gaming through a reverse merger into their public entity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's how we became public, and then we went on from there.
Great. And in 2017, you really took the quantum leap by acquiring Isle of Capri and its 20-some casinos at that point. So that brought you into being one of the largest regional casino companies. What made you decide to take that leap?
So we had, by that point, we had purchased MTR. We purchased the Reno assets
mm-hmm.
from MGM. And we had, going into this early on, our suspicion was there was a lot of unnecessary marketing subsidies in the regional space in particular.
Right.
And through those acquisitions, we had had the opportunity to test that theory and find that indeed, there were subsidies that didn't impact visitation that we could adjust, and that cash flow would fall to the bottom line. You know, Isle had and that way of operating was typical in the space. There was
sure.
really nobody that was testing it. And so Isle looked like others looked like. Isle had also a pretty large for its size centralized cost structure, and mm-hmm. we are a decentralized company, so we saw opportunity there. And you know, I'd known that management team for a very long time, so discussions were amicable the whole way, and we put that deal together.
Okay. And then when you started discussions with Tropicana, you came into contact with Carl Icahn, which I think, another quantum leap for the company.
That's right. That one actually came to us through GLPI,
okay,
who had started early discussions with Carl about buying the Tropicana entity.
Mm-hmm.
I got a call from Steve Snyder at the time asking, would you be interested in operating and buying the operating interest in these assets? And I said, sure, we would take a look. And, you know, we had done zero real estate financing at that point. Everything right. that we had was owned on balance sheet. And, you know, the effect of that transaction was we were buying a little less than half the business. GLPI was buying the other half, mm-hmm, in terms of what the lease payment would be.
Right.
And we would get all the upside in the transaction. So mm-hmm, we were buying at a lower multiple. And if we could drive the same operating upside we had driven in past acquisitions, you kind of turbocharge your returns.
Sure.
So, yeah, so I negotiated that deal with Carl, and that was a very good experience for both of us. Mm-hmm. And we bought the Tropicana assets at that point.
Right. And then, of course, that led to discussions about Caesars. And at that point, people were kind of looking sideways and thinking, El Dorado is going to buy Caesars? It was kind of like a David swallowing Goliath. How did that really come about? Obviously, Tony Rodio was in the middle of that one as well.
Yeah, so we had, obviously, as we had grown our business and delivered the returns that we delivered, we had developed some fans on the investment side of the space, people
sure,
that were
yeah.
investors throughout the sector, not just El Dorado. In the summer of 2018, there was dissatisfaction in terms of direction at Caesars, and I started to get calls from Caesars investors saying, we'd really like you to get involved here. Mm-hmm. And I had a connection with Don Kornstein, who was one of the Caesars board members, coincidentally was head of their strategy committee, and reached out to him in the summer of 18 and said, if I'm getting calls from your shareholders about their unhappiness, I can't imagine the calls that you're getting.
Sure, right, yeah.
If you're interested in examining a transaction, this is what we do, is we fix mm-hmm. broken operating entities, and we would be willing to take a look. Obviously, you're very large, so you know it would have to be some sort of merger transaction. And we had a very brief conversation where that went to the Caesars board. We talked briefly, and the Caesars board came back and said, we're not interested in moving forward, and you know, we moved on with our lives. Subsequent to that, in kind of fourth quarter of 18, I had had dinner with Carl after we closed the Tropicana deal and briefly talked about, you know, if you ever want to get back into gaming, mm-hmm. I think there's an opportunity in Caesars. And it was part of a 3-hour dinner with him that,
right.
you know, was not notable when we discussed it. It was a passing topic
sure.
of discussion and a very long dinner. And then, you know, toward the end of 18, there were press reports about him accumulating a stake. You know, we talked again. He asked, would you be interested in, you know, owning the whole company? And, you know, he knew of our interest in the summer. And I said, yeah, we'd be interested. And then, you know, as is typical, Carl doesn't tell you about his investment positions.
Sure,
I didn't
right.
know what his position was. And a couple of months later, I got a call from him and he said, I think I want to move them to transact here. And, you know, if you're still interested, I'd like you as a manager. And that was in late January of 19. And, you know, that's discussion started by probably beginning of March, and by June we had a transaction that we announced on June 24th.
Sure. So you know, I guess your relationship with institutional investors also, not just with Carl Icahn, played a big role in this. I mean, you know, since you went public after the MTR transaction, you know, you increased the stock price by tenfold, which is pretty amazing. So I guess you did have a lot of fans there. Did that help them to be comfortable with a deal of this size?
Sure. I mean, functionally, we're doing the same thing that we've done before. Mm-hmm. There's a corporate infrastructure that needs to be cut down to size, and we need to bring decision-making authority much closer to the customer, to the local level,
sure,
than was historically done in Caesars. And because it's not a command and control operating structure, I think people get comfortable that, yes, it's a lot, the numbers are bigger, but fundamentally what we're doing is the same thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was very important because we did, we offered a significant stock component in this deal. So shareholders had to believe I'm better off down this path than a standalone path.
Sure.
And there's been a lot of enthusiasm in the Caesars shareholder base and support all along, which has been heartening for us.
Sure. And, you know, a lot of the analysts have put a buy rating on Caesars now, which is encouraging as well. But of course, right after you announced the deal, not right after, but halfway through the regulatory approvals, COVID-19 hit. Did you have any fears that was going to torpedo the deal altogether at that point?
Well, I mean, at the time that happened, you're so overwhelmed with all of the operating decisions that you have to make.
Sure, right.
And you know, ultimately shutting our properties, ultimately furloughing employees, developing health and safety protocols with experts in the field, that you're kind of drinking from a fire hose, mm-hmm, as that's going on.
Right.
You know, once everything was closed and you start to calm down a bit, you do the underwriting again. You
know, yeah.
Our choices at that point were pursue the transaction as we had laid it out, mm-hmm, or, you know, look for somehow break the transaction and risk that you'd be paying, I think it was over $1 billion in breakup fees between,
right,
Caesars and Vici. So it becomes, you know, a math decision. What's the better outcome?
Yeah.
Are we better off on the path that we were headed down, or are we better off on a standalone basis with potentially $1 billion out the door in some, mm-hmm, form or fashion, and or some protracted litigation,
sure,
related to that breakup? So what I'd say is it was very easy and relatively quick decision,
yeah,
that the best outcome for our shareholders was to continue down the path that we'd went down. Mm-hmm. We had the benefit of 8 months of due diligence and seeing the specifics of where the opportunity was in Caesars. And really what our view at the time was all of the opportunity that we underwrote was still there.
Yeah.
Really what's happened is you've seen a timing shift.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, it's still the case that we should pursue the transaction. And so that's where we headed. And that was obviously a steep hill to climb, both from a regulatory perspective and from a financing perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of our mid-March to beginning of July task, was to, you know, speak to the regulators, to redo our numbers, tell them, you know, this everything that we showed you,
right,
last June is turned upside down. You know, this is what the model looks like now. And in the middle of that, you're starting to reopen properties. And what's been nice for us is the recovery in the business has been dramatically ahead of our expectations that we developed when everything was closed. And so all of the numbers have gotten easier. We had a fantastic outcome in our financing transactions, mm-hmm, where, because you got to remember, $1 billion went out the door second,
sure,
quarter,
right,
combined,
yeah, right,
between the two companies.
Mm-hmm.
Much more from the Caesar side in terms of burn rate, but $1 billion that was not in our calculations when we did the transaction. We got great execution on an equity offering, and then, you know, our debt capital raise, we came out with almost identical in terms of capital structure and cost of debt as we had underwritten and presented in our merger case when we announced the deal last June, which, you know, it's a testament to the work that was done on both sides, the recovery that had begun and we could speak about, but you also need luck. I mean, when we came to the credit markets shortly before we launched our financing, Fed Chairman Powell announced that the Fed was going to start buying corporate securities, and that led to a reduction in capital costs throughout the corporate world, and that was blind luck for us, but it was a great outcome.
A lot of assumptions were built into this deal before COVID in terms of cost saving and synergies and things of that nature. Did COVID affect that at all? That might even be even more beneficial then?
It did, particularly in the regional markets. We had been tackling the subsidies in the business in an incremental fashion in the in the companies that we had purchased, the properties we had purchased in our own properties, so as not to effectively go too far, which was always the concern among investors. What happens if you go too far and you turn customers off? Well, the health and safety situation, you know, first of all, from a capacity standpoint, we're operating at 50% capacity at best in most of our markets. So that led to you right-size your labor to match that. You've got health and safety around what you can do. You can't offer buffets in some places. You can't offer food service in a restaurant at all, like Atlantic City. Some places have limited or curtailed the ability to serve alcohol on the gaming floor. And so you got to look at all of those pieces of the business. Buffets were always a target of us, and the sector had not been following along at a pace that I would have expected. But now you've seen these properties with buffets shut down, and you see the level of business you're doing. Everybody gets a look at that now. And, you know, firstly, I don't know that the health and safety situation is going to change very quickly where you're even able to offer that type of offering. But I also believe that everybody in the space sees that that was just a subsidy, as I've described, that was unnecessary. And I don't think they're going to come back. And the average regional buffet in our system on a cash basis, fully loaded, loses $2 or $3 million a year. And you multiply that by 40, 45, 50 properties, those are real numbers that were not in our synergy analysis.
And that's with the minimal amount of employees you would have then. Now, if you open it up, you do employee serving the way they're doing it at some properties now. I mean, it's got to be much more expensive even then, you know.
That's right. So we're, I think there's been a fundamental shift in the way business will be done going forward that was certainly not in our original synergy analysis. At the time of our financing, we had $400 million of cost synergy in our original target, which was kind of our typical playbook of blocking and tackling at the corporate and property level. When we came with our financing, we've said we see another $400 million of opportunity that's a structural shift in the way business is done in the space.
FSB is more than just a platform. With more than 100,000 live sporting events traded by FSB teams each year, FSB has the experience to help you launch the most exciting U.S. sports betting operation. Built by experts with years of experience and powering some of the world's most successful brands, the FSB platform has been created to put you in charge of your business. FSB helps by creating online and retail solutions that are supported by an incredibly strong mobile offering with marketing, trading, payments, and all the other tools required to support a world-leading sports book. The FSB team is good, but their technology is great. And now back to our podcast.
So as you entered into the regulatory process, I think you did everything you thought was necessary in terms of selling properties. That would be competitive in the market with properties you were purchasing. So, you know, but there were still a couple of jurisdictions that were that forced you to do things that I guess, I don't know if you didn't foresee it or they just decided to put the screws on you while they had a chance. Were you anticipating these kind of demands and was that built into your financial plans?
So some yes, some no. We had to go through the FTC process,
right,
where they looked at the entity in totality in each of the individual markets, and there were some divestitures that we put in motion in Kansas City that was already in motion, but Shreveport and Lake Tahoe in particular that were to deal with FTC competition-related concerns. In Indiana, Caesars, you know, already is among the largest taxpayers in the state.
Right.
We would have controlled something like 60% of the gaming revenue in the state. And so Indiana was uncomfortable with that level of concentration, even though it was legislatively allowed. The Gaming Commission didn't think that that level of concentration was in the best interest of the state. We made the argument that these are all separate and distinct markets, but we respect that, you know, the state has to do what's in the best in their best interest. Mm-hmm. And their decision was we have to sell three assets, and so we've put those plans in motion, and we're actively starting to market those assets as we speak. In New Jersey, there we walked into some past history between Caesars and the commission that, frankly, there was no reason we would have been aware of it prior to the transaction. But the view in New Jersey is that Caesars assets have suffered for lack of investment, and that, you know, solving that problem takes capital and is necessary and will make those properties more competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And Caesars had dialogue in the past where, you know, the state's view would be that Caesars had promised to spend money and then just perpetually kicked it out.
Right.
And so they wanted us to make hard commitments on the front end.
Mm-hmm.
And we were willing to do that. The assets that we're talking about do need capital, and, you know, we're going to make those investments. That money's already in escrow, so from our perspective, it's already spent.
Yeah.
We're going to make sure that as it's invested, it's in pieces that will drive return for
mm-hmm.
us.
Yeah, no question. So, you know, Caesars has been known for a long time as being, you know, corporate heavy. You know, you always had to go to corporate to get approvals to do anything, basically. You had a lot of corporate development people, government affairs, analysts, and so forth. So will the new Caesars be more decentralized and give more power to the GMs and the presidents of the individual properties or the regions?
Yes, that's been our DNA.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All along, you know, our view is we make our money at the local level from the customers in these properties.
Right.
The more people you put between the frontline people that deal with them every day
mm-hmm.
and the person making the actual decisions, the poorer the outcome.
Right.
And Caesars, as you said, had a lot of centralized functions. You know, I would characterize it as, when I first got involved in looking at Caesars, the thought was there's some Wizard of Oz behind the curtain,
right,
that's, or a handful of guys that are pulling these levers,
right,
and that's what you need to look for. But as I get in here, what I find is really what happens is no one is 100% empowered to make a decision mm-hmm. virtually anywhere.
Right.
Everybody's got 60% or 40% or 80% of a decision. And, you know, what we want to do is go to a property and say, you know, your job is to make as much money as possible. Mm-hmm. We're going to tell you what our framework is in terms of driving business and operating. But if you think there's a better way and you can present numbers to us that show, mm-hmm. you know, hey, if I do this in Joliet, we're going to make more money.
Yeah.
And the numbers make sense, we're going to tell you, go do that. Mm-hmm. We're not going to tell you, we've got to put it through the sausage maker out here.
Sure.
And, you know, come back and say, we're not going to let you do it.
Right.
And, you know, Caesars was the gold standard for a very long time in this business in a number of areas, but, you know, management being chief among them. And there is talent at the operating level in Caesars that have been in this organization for 10, 15, 20 years mm-hmm. that have been handcuffed a bit by the way
right.
decisions were made. And we're really just trying to take the handcuffs off and let talented operators do what they do best.
Sure. Well, you do have some great people in all the properties in Las Vegas and Atlantic City, which I'm most familiar with. But even in the regional properties, you know, the people you have in place there really know that region. So I think that's a great, great strategy for sure. So lots of the value of Caesars has always been the Caesars of rewards, or what we used to call total rewards. Millions of names, and you've got a couple million names that Eldorado can bring to the table. So what are the plans to enhance the Caesars rewards program?
So Caesars has about 50 million people in its database. We bring 12 of our own.
Mm-hmm.
So for our customer base, that's our legacy customer base, that's an exciting opportunity for those customers to be able to use their points at play in destination markets like Las Vegas that are easy to access. And so we think that that's going to increase play at the local level, which is historically what has happened within Caesars, but we think it's also going to improve our yielding opportunity in Las Vegas and the other destination markets within Caesars, because there's going to be more competition for what at the outset will be the same amount of rooms. So, and you've seen kind of the power of Caesars rewards in the relative operating performance on the Strip over the last 3 years or so. Caesars did, you know, the best in terms of driving, hotel profitability and casino profitability when times were good,
mm-hmm.
and they're doing it again now when we're in harder times in Vegas, where you're seeing us operate at, you know, something like 1.5 to 2x the occupancy of mm-hmm. our peers. It's because of that Caesars Rewards database.
Right.
But I also look to, you know, what can we do with that database as we move forward? That's, you're talking about a significant percentage of the adults in the United States are a part of this system.
Sure.
And particularly when you look at a significant percentage of those that actually are spenders, that have mm-hmm. disposable income, that they've shown a propensity and willingness to an ability and willingness to spend. So that's a valuable piece of the business. There are a lot of businesses that make a lot of money in terms of how do you optimize a database.
Mm-hmm.
And databases in the casino business have typically just been used to figure out how much do I have to give you to generate a visit.
Right.
I think there are things that you can do with these databases that can drive value beyond do I give you a free room when you show up in mm-hmm. Las Vegas. And then you look at markets where we have a map that's pretty well developed now domestically.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of blanks in that map, but markets where we're not a participant, and we're not likely to become a participant in the future, is there a way for us to offer somebody in that market the ability to use Caesars Rewards
sure.
as their marketing system,
mm-hmm.
Where it's still their database? I'm not looking to steal their customers,
right.
but the key piece of Caesars Rewards is the cross-market play that's generated. That was a striking factor as we did due diligence and went to the properties And each of them would tell us, mm-hmm. here's how much cross-market play
right.
is generated in the system. And having owned and operated and purchased a number of properties from other operators, there's nobody in the business that develops
sure. right.
and generates the cross-market play that Caesars does. Yep. So if I can utilize the brand of that program in a market where I'm not a competitor, there's a lot of tribal markets,
sure,
there's markets
right.
in
yep.
the Northeast yep. where we're not a player,
right.
I think that could be an opportunity going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to a lot of players who say they give all their play to Caesars because they want to be on the rewards program, they want to go to Las Vegas once a year, maybe they want to go to Biloxi, maybe they want to go to one of your other resorts, and it just generates so much loyalty that it just makes sense for sure. So another brand that Caesars has is a World Series of Poker. Very powerful brand, as a standalone poker tournament. But of course, it's expanded online in the last few years. They're really the only online poker room in Nevada that counts. Do you have plans for that in terms of developing that a little more?
Yeah, that's a significant asset for us. The brand and the business they've developed is extraordinary, and we have significant assets online, both in all three of poker, internet casino, and sports. And we think that there's an opportunity to drive value for stakeholders by defining a go-forward strategy that's clear and succinct and investable for mm-hmm. investors. And we think World Series can be a big part of that.
Sure, no question. And you made a deal, I think, when you were with El Dorado, to bring William Hill in and to run the sports books for you guys. That deal is going to include Caesars at this point. So why did you choose to do that, rather than kind of rely on the Caesars expertise, which has been here for a long time?
Well, when we did that deal, we didn't have the Caesars expertise
right.
because
right.
we were El Dorado. Mm-hmm. So we were looking at who would be a good partner for us. We were looking for someone to partner with in our sports books to run our retail books. But we recognized that the access that we provided to the map was of significant value to a potential partner. So
right.
in the state we were as El Dorado, our view was El Dorado was never going to have the brand to be a national player.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we should look for a partner that has aspirations to build a national brand mm-hmm. and that will let us participate in that upside. And we had an existing partnership with William Hill and Joe Asher that had gone quite well for us. We talked to a number of potential partners, mm-hmm. but it was very clear to us that, both economically and operationally, that William Hill was our best option.
Right.
And we signed that deal prior to the Caesars deal. And so then we go out and purchase Caesars. And as you said, Caesars has a very different portfolio in this area and brands that resonate with the customer. So, the way that the deal is structured with William Hill is William Hill steps into the Caesars sports books. We keep all of our internet casino, online casino, and online mm-hmm. poker business, and that's how we would move forward. I don't know that that's optimal for either side.
Right.
William Hill has been a terrific partner for us, but if you ask them, I'm sure they'd tell you we'd like a single wallet solution
sure.
that
right. Right.
solves for all of those areas, and mm-hmm. they don't have a path to that
right.
in the current partnership, and we would tell you the Caesars brands and the sports partnerships that it
right.
brings are, much more fulsome and will drive much more value than what El Dorado brought to the mm-hmm. table on its own. So what you should expect is, we're looking for a path that's in the best interest of both the partners and the stakeholders on all sides.
Sure.
And we see the valuations that are out there for pure play opportunities there and, the stories that are told in terms of their investment stories. And there are some compelling stories out there it's an extremely exciting and large opportunity for the space. It's the biggest, I said this on our earnings call, this is the biggest growth opportunity for gaming since riverboats were legalized in the 90s. But we want to start with what's the right solution for our customers, how we run the business, how can we garner the largest market share? Then we get to, you know, what is the structure of that entity? What's the box you put it in? How do you capitalize that box?
Yeah.
You know, so we're mindful of the opportunity that's out there and the valuations that are out there, but we're making a 10, 15, 25 year decision here. You know, we're not just going to rush out and print a spinoff because we could get a good valuation right now.
Right, okay. So you will retain the online casino and online sports books operations as well.
Under the current partnership agreement, correct.
Right. So, you know, obviously we saw the impact of online casino in New Jersey where it was legal during COVID. I mean, that was a pretty dramatic impact on the industry there. And obviously I think other states have sat up and noticed that. So what kind of role are you going to play in the expansion of online gaming into states where you already operate land-based casinos?
We will be a leader in arguing for implementation, as you noted. States that have budget difficulty and are looking at places like New Jersey and Pennsylvania that were able to generate tax revenue when the world was shut down, I'm sure that's going to get people's attention. I'm hopeful that leads to a rollout that's quicker than we were anticipating. Mm-hmm. On the internet casino side, that business has a much quicker path to profitability than sports. And you know, you saw we were talking about New Jersey in the second quarter, where in 2020, we're on the path to margins in the mid to high 30s. Mm-hmm. So that's very exciting for us as an opportunity. And, you know, we'd expect to be active in trying to move for a rollout throughout the country.
Sure. So, you know, as El Dorado, you didn't have a lot of online presence in terms of casino. But Caesars, you know, frankly, doesn't have that much either. I mean, like just New Jersey, and you know, you're not a market leader there. But are you looking to do something unique and innovative in the online casino area?
We're working on the William Hill side is working on the technology relative to the app that both sides recognize, you know, needs to be brought up to a higher level, and we think that will help us to compete in that area. We need to invest across the board so that we know that we're going to be a leader. But the pieces that we can bring as a combined entity in terms of partnerships with, you know, on the sports side, ESPN and CBS, are quite powerful. Caesars has an NFL partnership where you see that the draft was going to be here this year. There's a lot of powerful building blocks for a business that can be a leader, and it's the Caesars Rewards database on the casino side that should be able to drive significant business, subject to us having the technology right on the app side.
Sure, great. Another deal you had that predated the Caesars deal was the arrangement with Cordish in Pompano Beach to develop that casino there, and also their live product that they've done so well with around the country. Is that something that you can see, you know, maybe you do more of as a Caesars company?
We would love to do more business with Cordish in particular. They're very good partners. They're brilliant at real estate development and building those, building the plan that you can just see is going to drive significant traffic to, you know, what's a spectacular location in South Florida. So we're excited for that. We look at real estate opportunities throughout the portfolio and would look to do more of that, because that's, you know, to me, that is the key. It's not, do I give you a buffet? Do I give you a room? Right. Do I give you free play? It's, can I invest capital or other people's capital that want to be adjacent to the magnet that is a casino to drive reasons to show up beyond the casino? That's the Las Vegas story over the last 25 years.
Right.
You haven't really seen it happen at the regional level to any significant degree. In the areas where we have the real estate to do it, we think that's we've seen the roadmap here.
Yeah, and I think that's the important aspect of gaming going forward. It's a great experience. If you can gamble online, why are you going to come to a casino just to gamble?
If you can
do all these other things, I think that makes a lot of sense. So I just have one more question. You were quoted a few weeks ago saying everything is for sale. And we know you talked about selling a property here in Las Vegas on the Strip to decentralize that a little bit. And I understand you're not going to tell me which property you're talking to now, but does this go across the country in all Caesars locations that, everything's up for sale for the right price?
Yeah, I mean, what I've said historically is we are economic animals. We're driven to maximize the value of the company for all of our stakeholders. Mm-hmm. If the right way to go about that is to sell an asset, a portfolio of assets, the entire company, that's better than the path that we're on on a standalone basis.
Sure.
Absolutely. I mean, we've become the largest domestic operator, but that was not the goal when we set out. Mm-hmm. We're not married to our size or any particular asset. We have significant plans to drive value through the existing portfolio. We have a handful of divestitures that we have scheduled. We talked about Indiana.
Sure.
That was regulatory driven. Mm-hmm. We have spoken publicly about we would like to sell an asset on the Strip. We were hopeful that that would be in the first 12 months post-closing, given the environment with the virus. That might be the first 12 to 18 months. But really, that's a decision made based on we don't need to have 24,000 rooms in a single market to fill every night.
Mm-hmm.
If I can tighten that yield management that I talked about by adding the El Dorado customers to the database and then tighten it further by reducing the amount of rooms I have to fill and have $1.5 billion or $2 billion available to me to pay down debt, I think that's the right answer for our stakeholders. We're certainly still going to have plenty of exposure to the Strip market, but we would expect to sell an asset. And as I sit here today, I read all the speculation that you do that the decision's already been made and it's this asset or that asset. I can tell you there has not been a decision. We're in active dialogue. And if there were a perfect answer, we would have the decision made. But there's pluses and minuses to each potential candidate. And we're going to take the time to analyze that over this period of time and not hurry to make a quick choice.
Great. Well, Tom, congratulations on the Caesars deal. It's been a long road to get here, but it looks like you've got plans to continue to go forward and to make this to increase the shareholder value. I think that's obviously your goal in every one of these transactions, and it certainly has worked out so far. There's no reason to think it wouldn't now. So thanks for the time, and we hope to catch up with you again pretty soon.
And thanks for your time, Roger. We're very excited to finally be started here after a long process between signing and closing.
Great. Thank you. Hope you enjoyed this week's podcast brought to you by FSB, the industry's leading sports betting solutions and technology platform. For more information, visit fsbtech.com. To learn more about the deal that created the world's largest gaming company, visit ggbmagazine.com. To get all the news of the gaming industry, particularly of the coronavirus situation and its impact on gaming, including daily updates, subscribe for free at ggbnews.com by using the code GGB180. Don't miss a single episode of the GGB Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes or Spotify today. So we'll see you next week on the GGB Podcast.